Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. I'm your host, Corey Fleck, also co-hosted here by Shad Marquit. Now, Shad and I are going to be discussing a lot of the moves in commodity sector again, but we are going to kick off this show with a focus a bit more on U.S. equity markets. Quite frankly, because U.S. equity markets were just steadily climbing. You look at the Dow, S&P, NASDAQ, for the last almost 2 weeks about, boy, oh boy, these markets have been kind of boring to the upside. We started to see a little bit of weakness earlier on this week, and I know there's still a lot of bears out there saying it just doesn't make sense that these markets keep on grinding, but it was quite the environment where day after day markets were up 0.25% to 0.5%, seemingly again every day, and they all reached new all-time highs. Shad and I are kicking off this show with Jesse Felder, founder and editor of the Felder Report. Now, Jesse, one thing we were chatting about off mic that you pointed out was this dispersion that we're seeing between markets continuing to move higher and breadth that really is cratered, especially in the NASDAQ. Take us through some of the data on this dispersion that we are seeing between the markets and overall breadth, please.
Yeah, well, it's been fascinating to watch, the NASDAQ power the markets higher over the last few weeks. We saw interest rates peak out, a few months ago and turn down, and that's been really kind of bullish for this, for a rebound in the growth versus value trade. But as a result of that, we've seen, I think the Russell 2000 peaked maybe back in March, sometime in the spring, and has just moved sideways, hasn't made a new high, since, even as the NASDAQ is powering higher. And, the NASDAQ has been taking the S&P 500 with it. But what we're seeing in the NASDAQ is literally the worst breadth readings in the history of that index, as it makes new highs. Sentiment Trader, my friend Jason Gepford, has been kind of all over this trend. He pointed out that I think it was yesterday when the NASDAQ closed at a 52-week high. It's done that on over 1,000 days, individual days, since 1984. On average, 50%, at least 50% of the stocks in the NASDAQ were advancing on the day that the market made a new high, that index. Yesterday, only 31% of the stocks were actually advancing when that index made a new high. So the vast majority of stocks actually were declining on a day that the index made a new high. And the majority of them are all below their own, moving averages, whether it's, you're talking about 50 or 200-day moving averages. I think there's a ton of stocks still trading below their 50-day moving averages within the NASDAQ, which is a pretty clear breadth warning. You can see it across different indexes too. As I mentioned, S&P's pushing new highs just because it has such a heavy weighting towards these big NASDAQ names like Apple and Microsoft. But Russell 2000's not. And you have the Dow, like you mentioned, the industrials are kind of pushing to new highs, but the transports are looking much weaker. And that's a classic Dow theory non-confirmation, which historically is kind of an economic warning. But it's also a stock market warning pointing to that breadth is just not anywhere near as healthy as it should be right now.
Well, Jesse, that's a really interesting observation. So what do you think that means under the surface of things? Because a lot of people just track the indexes, but if there's more and more people piling into a more and more narrow field of companies, what does that actually mean under the surface for the strength of these markets? Are they in danger of having a corrective move here?
I think one of the things I think is helpful to keep in mind is if you look at the pattern of the S&P 500 index going back to early 2018, to me, it looks like a megaphone pattern or a broadening top pattern, whatever you choose to call it from a technical perspective. But Edwards and McGee, in their famous technical analysis book, call this broadening top pattern, quote unquote, market out of control. And, we've seen liquidity drop dramatically in all markets, but in the stock market, especially if you look at S&P 500 futures liquidity, it's just dropped dramatically. And so we saw the stock market really take off into early 2018, the Volmageddon crash, and then stocks went up, made new highs. Powell raised interest rates, market kind of crashed into late 18 and bottomed around Christmas time of 2018. Then we saw a huge surge in the market. And then obviously the COVID crash made new lows. And so now we've pushed up to new highs again. And this latest push higher has been largely a result of a speculative mania driven by, retail traders just piling into the market like maybe we've never seen before in history. So I do think this is a stock market that's out of control. The latest, rise in the market over the last, 15, 16 months is really a result of a speculative mania driven by retail traders. And if you look at this dispersion, you see it in names like, a lot of these popular meme stock names are really rolling over hard. Plug Power is one that I was watching early in the year because that was one that was a really good sentiment indicator during the dot-com mania when that stock just screamed higher and then broke and started to crash. It was a good sign that retail fever 20 plus years ago was breaking at the same time. Plug is now down 60% off its peak, but even things like AMC and GameStop are starting to roll over today. Breaking down out of, kind of sideways or pennant patterns, however you want to call them. But if those signs are pointing to, the possibility of retail finally giving up, this retail fad starting to wane, then that's bad news for a market that has become very highly reliant on those flows into the market to push prices higher.
So, Jesse, doesn't this all just tell us that we still see rotation within these markets, even though we don't have very good breadth or horrible breadth in these markets? Money's not exactly leaving the markets. It's just being focused a bit more on select stocks. And it seems like a bit more on some of these high-flying tech stocks, because I read an article earlier this week that said something about Amazon gaining around $100 billion in market cap in just 2 days of trading. So, again, we're just seeing this rotation of money.
Yeah, it appears like a rotation, and that's exactly what it appeared like, too, in 2000. We had, the NASDAQ blew off and peaked in March of that year, rolled over, never made a new high, but then, money kind of went out of growth and into value, and then the New York Stock Exchange Composite made a new high in September of 2000, as it looked like, people were just rolling out of these crazy growth names into value. And then the market rolled in, late in 2000, early into 2001, rolled over into a bigger decline. So a lot of these rotation periods, if you look at, we've seen charts of the correlation, between indexes and between growth and value. And the last time the correlation dropped between these things so much, between growth and value, to where it was such a strong rotation as we're seeing today, was in, in the middle of 2000. When we were seeing a similar type of rotation. And to me, that rotation, in order to be sustainable, really needs to support those growth names, because they've become such a huge part of the market. So as long as the growth trade is sustainable, then the market can probably hold up. But a couple of things I'm paying close attention to. One is, a lot of this dispersion can be, potentially retail traders' participation kind of waning. But also, if you look at smart money indicators, and there's two that I pay close attention to. One is essentially the insider sell to buy ratio. We're seeing that's just literally screamed to new highs, where insider selling over the last 12 months has far outweighed insider buying. And the last time we saw this this indicator, approach anywhere near as high as it is today was kind of late 14 into early 2015. And if you remember that period, the market went nowhere over the next 12 months. We had a pretty steep sell-off in August of 2015 and then into early 2016. And so that's, to me, a sign that, the smartest of smart money, the insiders, corporate executives are getting out. There's another smart money index I pay attention to, and that is essentially just the close of trading versus the opening of trading. They say the opening of trading in the market is usually when retail are kind of piling into the markets or doing their trading. Smart money trades at the end of the day. And so when you see weakness at the end of the day relative to the beginning of the day, it's a sign that institutional investors are starting to liquidate, and that even as the S&P 500 has been moving higher over the last few weeks, that smart money index has started to roll over, which to me points to potentially institutional investors starting to lighten up on equities.
Jesse, there's a couple of interesting points there to digest for people. And it sounds like if there's a narrowing focus of retail investors piling in and the markets become dependent on that, but the breadth is so low, and if there's this end of the day selling and the institutional, are on the sell side more than the buy side, including insiders, if they are more selling than buying, doesn't that paint a picture that you're, like you're saying, that the smart money senses things are getting a little excessive, and that this reopening trade and that this inflation trade and that this, you know, now that the pandemic's passed and everybody's traveling again and they're shopping again and they're out cruising and they're, you know, flying around the country, isn't that all maybe getting a little bit ahead of itself? And isn't the smart money sensing that in a way?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's exactly what we're seeing, is that, you know, if you look at how all of these trends have gone, when people were locked down and couldn't, you know, go do things, then they got into trading. And now that the market is reopening, and the economy is reopening and people can get back to traveling and doing all these things, I'm seeing it. I'm on the road. I've been in, you know, Sun Valley, Idaho, and Breckenridge, Colorado, and I'm in Yellowstone now. And I'm saying everybody is out and about and doing things again. And they're going to, you know, I think we're starting to see that waning of retail trading. People are going to say, hey, you know what, I'm not locked down anymore, and hey, my trading is not working out so spectacularly. Maybe I did buy AMC or GameStop and at, you know, near the top, and it's not doing what I thought it was going to do. People are going to burn out on this. Trading is an extremely difficult thing to do consistently and successfully, and it's not something that you know, you can just read a couple posts on Reddit and make money, you know, overnight, at least not consistently. And so I think people are going to burn out on this. There's just not that many people that are able to do this successfully. It's like anything else. I mean, you know, the vast majority of people are going to be unsuccessful. Now, I really hope for their sake that you know, it's a good thing to that people are becoming interested in markets and learning and all those things, and I hope they maintain some kind of a passion for it. But I think for most people, day trading is not the most effective way to kind of express that, or that passion for the markets. And I do think we're probably going to see that fading, and we're probably seeing it fade already. And that's kind of the reason why we're seeing some of the action in the market we're seeing right now.
Yeah, makes sense. Look, that pandemic sure brought a whole new audience into the market and caused some pretty interesting market moves. But you're right, people are getting away from the markets because they're getting away from their house, finally. So that is a big change that's coming within the market. But Jesse, just encompassing this whole narrative around weak breadth in these markets, but markets still holding up there, and that move a bit more into the growth trade. How much do lower interest rates have to do with this? Because it wasn't that long ago that we were talking about a rising interest rate environment, but now we look at something like the 10-year, that's back to levels we haven't seen since February of this year, back when it was trending higher. Now rates are trending lower. How critical is that to understand about how markets could potentially be supported, especially growth?
Well, it's a great question. I think it absolutely does help to explain a lot of the rotation we've seen. Rising interest rates, typically good for value versus growth, and small cap over large cap. And so, and that's what we've seen, right? Interest rates bottomed back in March of last year, and rose until March of this year. So over that 12-month period, value outperformed growth, and small caps outperformed large caps. But rates peaked back in, you know, March, April, and started to roll over pretty hard over the last couple of weeks. And so what have we seen? We've seen growth start to outperform value again for the first time in a while. And small caps, you know, like I mentioned, have underperformed large caps. And so, yeah, that does explain it to a pretty significant degree. But that's one of the reasons why I've been looking at interest rates so carefully. But one of the things I'm seeing now is, I use DeMarc indicators for technical, you know, analysis purposes. We just saw today a daily DeMarc buy signal on the 30-year yield, which suggests rates could be bottoming here. And at the same time, we've seen tons of money pour into like ETFs like TLT. We've seen small speculators in 30-year futures just who are massively short, buying a lot of their shorts over the last couple of weeks. So I think sentiment is turning towards bullish bonds again, right as technically rates could be bottoming and turning higher again. If that's the case, then, you know, this growth stock over value and large over small could potentially reverse again.
Well, speaking of interest rates, that usually ties into currencies, and the currencies ties into other aspects of the market. So what do you think about the recent strength in the dollar, which has pressured the commodity sector? And how does that, and, you know, is that strength in the dollar something that's sustainable, and will it continue to pressure commodities, or will this move also be muted? Because we saw the commodities have a great run at the beginning of the year, and then they've just gotten kind of hammered the last couple months as the dollar was selling off. That's why the commodities ran. But now that the dollar is bouncing, they're getting creamed, and that seems to tie into the interest rate factor.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, all these markets are closely interrelated: interest rates and currencies and commodities. And to me, I've been saying since January, I think my first market comment I wrote of 2020 was last year. 2020 is going to be the year to watch the dollar. And I still feel that way. It's been, you know, a year and a half, and I'm still watching it as the most closely watched chart in everything I'm looking at, simply because I do think it is going to dictate the direction for a lot of different things. Obviously, you know, the oil price is probably the most important one to watch in terms of commodities. It's kind of probably the heaviest component in most commodity indexes. And it's a big driver of inflation and these things. I've been bearish on the dollar and bullish on energy for you know, at least a year now. The dollar's rolled over, but this bounce that we've seen is really, to me, not a very encouraging technical structure. If you're looking at a daily chart, yeah, I could see why you'd be maybe potentially bullish on the dollar. But any longer term, you look at a weekly or a monthly chart, and it's just bouncing off this 88, 89 horizontal support level. And until it, really kind of convincingly puts in a bottom above that, then I think we have to worry about a breakdown. Fundamentally, you know, the twin deficits are very bearish for the dollar. I think that's an important bearish driver for the currency. But in the short run, I think it's, you know, one of the things I pay close attention to. I mentioned small speculators in the long bond a minute ago. Small speculators in dollar index futures, too, have put on their biggest net long position in years, in three or four years or something recently, which tells me these kind of weak bounces in the dollar have been enough to get people really optimistic and bullish on the greenback, which is not very encouraging to me if I were a dollar bull. I'd want to see people with that's, you know, just bouncing right above long-term key horizontal support. I'd want to see people getting really bearish and worried about a breakdown, and they're doing just the opposite. We're seeing small speculators get very bullish on the dollar, and that's not a good sign. That tells me that if the dollar index does roll over again, as I think it probably will, There's a bunch of money that probably needs to, you know, get out of dollars and could catalyze that breakdown below support. Now, that would probably be, you know, obviously bullish for commodities, oil, gold, etc.
Jesse, when it comes to the dollar in particular, but also commodities, any other countries that you're watching closely? China gets referred to a lot when it comes to the commodity complex, especially what's going on in some base metals and other metals. But also considering what happens in the dollar index, what goes on in Europe too. So you focusing elsewhere on other countries, seeing any moves there?
Yeah, I think, you know, as I mentioned, I think the one I'm watching most closely is, the oil price. And I think, you know, what's driving that is a lack of, you know, production picking up in the shale space. In the past, over the last, 10 years, we've seen shale rise and become, you know, a really important player in the overall, you know, supply of oil globally. in the past, 5 years or so, when the oil price has risen, shale has ramped up production, and that's kind of kept a lid on prices. The oil price has been ripping higher, and these shale producers are not ramping up production. Nobody really wants them to. I mean, investors in the energy stocks don't want them to, and politically, nobody wants them to ramp up production either, from ESG things to the government wanting to be more green and et cetera, et cetera. So I think you have that from the shale side, which is kind of putting an important change in the supply dynamic that we haven't seen in years. At the same time, OPEC, obviously can't get its act together and raise production, even though the oil price is ripping higher and economies are reopening. That this combined, lid on supply paired with rapidly rising demand around the world could make for much higher oil prices over the next several months, or at least around a year or something like that. And so, I mean, I think that's something to pay really close attention to, because oil prices are so important in terms of consumer inflation expectations and how much they play into CPI and these things. So I think you can't really think about the inflation debate without understanding these underlying oil price dynamics. And then from a larger standpoint, too, the big commodity boom we saw, over the past 20 years was China, investing massively. Right now, we're seeing, China's still investing. And now we have a U.S. that wants to invest in infrastructure and making a greener economy. We potentially have two superpowers for the first time in history undergoing massive infrastructure investment at the same time, which is going to be a driver, I think, for a commodity super cycle over a number of years. There are famous supply constraints in all kinds of things, from copper to a lot of these commodities that go into electric vehicles. And so I think we're seeing demand come from a lot of important places all at the same time. And we've made no investment in expanding supplies. And so I do think, from a long-term perspective, we are seeing the very early innings of a commodity super cycle. And all these corrections are probably opportunities to buy the dip.
Yeah, Jesse, just to kind of summarize what you've just said, it sounds like you're laying out a case for an increased commodity market, because you're talking about a dollar that could roll over and weaken. You're discussing the fact that there's structural challenges in the oil market that could force that higher. And oil is a huge input into the inflation side of things. And if inflation is going to run hotter and we're in this big infrastructure build out globally, not just the United States or China, but really everywhere, the electrification of the emerging markets and the EV push and all of these different projects and initiatives are in place. Do you think that there really is legs for this commodity super cycle? Because a lot of people doubt it. And do you think inflation will be part of the driver of it?
I think there are huge legs potentially for this. If you look at past super cycles, commodities are still extremely cheap. It's amazing to me to see how much they've run up, but then to see also how cheap they are still relatively to financial assets. I mean, we're still at the cheapest levels in history in terms of, commodity index relative to the S&P or, any of those types of things. And so it tells me there's just still huge potential upside. The other side of this is, too, that the markets right now are pricing in the transitory narrative. Literally any market you want to look at is pricing in same old, same old, that we're going to have disinflation just like we've had for the last 40 years. Now, if it turns out that inflation is more than transitory, institutional investors across the board are so underweight all of the things that could make a difference to their portfolios in terms of an inflationary environment. There's massively underweight gold, massively underweight commodities, tips, all these things, even real estate. But I think commodities and gold are probably the biggest potential beneficiaries. Energy stocks, too. I mean, with the huge surge in flows into ESG funds, I think we're just starting to see ESG underperform as a result of energy stocks performing so well. But institutional investors can only tolerate that type of underperformance for so long before they're going to get fired. And if, like I said, if inflation proves to be more than transitory, And I think it's highly likely at this point that's going to be the case, just from all the drivers that we're seeing. You know, doesn't look like there's any reprieve in sight. Then the flows that are going to go into these things, that the only things that will protect you in an inflationary environment, are going to be so massive that it's going to take massive price gains in a lot of these things to close the gap between real assets and financial assets. And so there's still potential, terrific, I think, potential upside for commodities, gold, oil prices, energy stocks, et cetera.
All right, Jesse, we're going to wrap it up there. Thanks, as always, for your comments. I really enjoy reading over the Felder Report, and I really thank you for coming on our show, breaking down a kind of big picture look here at what's going on in markets and also what could come for commodities. Boy, oh boy, it's been an interesting year, and that's following 2020 that nobody saw coming. So where we go from here, big question marks, but there is still a lot of system or a lot of money in this system, just where it's going to move to next. I think that's the key consideration. Jesse, thanks as always for your time, buddy. We'll chat again soon. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend.
Always a pleasure talking to you guys. Thanks.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.